You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. And joining us today on Perspectives is Todd Wilkinson. Todd Wilkinson is a reporter, journalist, and he has written several books. He has been a professional journalist and author for more than 25 years, with assignments that have taken him around the world. He is the author of several books, including the critically acclaimed Science Under Siege, The Politician's War on Nature and Truth. His most recent book, Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. Todd, thank you very much for being with us here today.
It's my pleasure.
Now, this book that you just wrote about Ted Turner, Last Stand, first of all, most reporters would say that this was probably a very tough assignment because interviewing Ted Turner would be more difficult than interviewing perhaps the President of the United States, General Haig, or anybody like that. And you encountered that during the first question when you mentioned buffalo instead of saying bison, correct?
Absolutely. First time that I interviewed Ted Turner was in 1992. And at that point, he was this cocky, very strapping figure who was very adept at dismissing journalists and trying to put us in our place, even though he himself had become a journalist. If he wasn't impressed with the questions that you were asking, he might cut an interview off.
At what point did you decide to take on this assignment, or was this something you did on your own as a freelance writer?
Well, that's a great question. I had, again, interviewed Ted a long time ago, and at that point, many of his initiatives that are parallel to his work as a so-called media mogul were just starting to take shape, and we didn't know in what direction they were going. He was just starting to build a bison herd, for example. He was just starting to build the Atlanta Braves into a World Series contender. His media bets were just starting to pay off, and of course, he was just starting his land buying spree, which resulted in him buying nearly 1 million acres of land just north of you guys in New Mexico. And so all of this stuff was happening. And then maybe 15 years later, I approached him about writing a book, though I didn't want it to be a shameless hagiography, i.e. a tribute book to Ted Turner. I really wanted to dive deep into what he was doing. Not only on his land management issues in the American West, which made him the world's or the country's largest landowner at the time, but also his philanthropic efforts that really reach around the globe.
A lot of people also have the misconception that Ted Turner is a rich, rich man who probably was spoon-fed all his life, and that's not the case. He had a tough childhood growing up.
No, absolutely. You know, there's Ted Turner, the public persona. The irony of Ted Turner is that he's actually an introvert, that he really puts on this tough, cantankerous face as a self-defense mechanism. And what I wanted to do was two things. One, write an adventure story that makes sense about a guy who would build a bison herd of 55,000 animals and welcome grizzly bears and wolves into his backyard and give $1 billion to the United Nations and start an organization devoted to eradicating nuclear weapons. I wanted to tell this story and make it riveting so that it would be a page-turner, but at the same time, what's crucial was diving into Ted Turner's psyche and understanding his psychological profile. And as you mentioned, he had a very troubled childhood. He lost his only sister at a young age that caused him to start questioning religion. He then had a very troubled relationship with his own father, who was grooming him to take over this billboard company in the southeast. And at age 24, his father committed suicide. And it caused, again, a lot of trauma in Ted Turner's life, something that he's still trying to reconcile. You know, at the end of the day, Ted Turner is a human being just as we are. He has struggled with things like everyone does. One of the things that I found really poignant is that when I interviewed Jane Fonda, his wife of 10 years, She said Ted Turner is really trying to save the world as an attempt to try and save himself.
Interesting. You did mention about his troubled childhood, his troubled youth, and you mentioned about his father grooming him to take over that billboard business. One thing that I found interesting was the fact that his father had him paired up to toughen him up. It was an African-American man.
Yes, and he was proved to be a pivotal figure in Ted's life. Jimmy Brown had known Ted's father and was descended from Gullah slaves in the Southeast. And Jimmy Brown taught Ted Turner how to sail and brought him out into nature and really served as a surrogate father figure. And, you know, there were three men that really had a poignant place in Ted's life. One was Jimmy Brown, another was Ted's father, and the third one was Jacques Cousteau.
Jim taught Ted a lot more than just being in the wild and surviving. Taught him a little bit about being a person and some of the struggles that people go through.
Absolutely. Jimmy Brown was probably the most human figure that figured in Ted's early life, someone to whom he could relate. And, you know, he taught Ted Turner the value of modesty and humility. You know, again, it cuts against the grain of the public persona that Ted Turner has. You know, Ted Turner fundamentally relates to the world from the mindset of an underdog. With all of his business ventures and with everything he's done in philanthropy and again, his environmental work, people have told him that he could never do it. And it was the encouragement of someone like Jimmy Brown who said, "Mr. Ted, you can do anything you want, but you've got to apply yourself." And so it really is a picking oneself up by the bootstraps and trying to do well in the world.
A lot of books, a lot of stories, Todd, about men like Ted Turner who struggled in their childhood and growing up either to please a dad or to please their mom. And this was
Absolutely.
The case.
Yes, it was. You know, in that way, it's an archetypal story. It's the story of how many of us become overachievers because we lack self-esteem. And so there's certainly that psychological profile that exists in Ted Turner. And it's something that, you know, is recognized in a lot of others. One thing, if you don't mind, that I'd like to mention is I really wanted to write Last Stand for it to serve as a handhold or a counterpoint to business as usual. Ted Turner believes in capitalism, but he thinks that we're not going to consume our way from a natural resource perspective out of the huge challenges that are facing us. And I think everyone could realize that, you know, residents of El Paso understand it from the point of water. Without water, we in the West dry up and we blow away. And what Ted really does is he serves as an example of how the business community can think differently about eco-capitalism. This isn't greenwashing. This is the real deal. And so I hope that the book speaks to that.
Todd, some of my family is from northern New Mexico, and so my father-in-law shared with me, you know, some of the lands that are owned by Ted Turner up there. And it's beautiful landscape. You know, anyone who has never been to northern New Mexico, it's gorgeous up there. And you see these mountains, you see these roving ranges, and you see the antelope and some bison and some deer, elk, everything. And this is something that's incredible, I find, in the book, because Mr. Turner started out with, Mr. Turner's his father, as he addresses, right?
Yes.
Ted started out with a herd of three bison.
Yes, he did. And he raised them on a property that he owned south of Charleston, South Carolina, which for those of us in the West who deal with dry humidity, bison aren't very fond of wet humidity, 110% humidity in the Southeast. And Ted looked west knowing that if he was going to have a true bison herd, he needed to have enough lands to support it. And so his land buying spree really was done in support of building his bison herd. And you mentioned that wonderful country of northern New Mexico. I mean, it's magical and spiritual, and it's something that's had a huge impact on Ted. And Vermejo Park Ranch, which is the largest of all the properties Ted owns, it became a place where, you know, his bison restoration has proceeded. And I should note, this is a really interesting thing, is that some of the bison that he inherited when he bought the ranch were actually descended from Yellowstone National Park. They had been shipped there, and they're pure strain bison. They're bison that don't have any cattle genes in them, and they're one of only four or five herds that have those pure bison genes left out of 35 million that once inhabited the West.
We're visiting with Todd Wilkerson. Todd is a reporter, journalist, author, and most recently his latest work is Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. As we continue talking about bison, Todd, one of the things that Ted wants to do, and you found that out in your first interview, the fact that he says reporters should be smart, they should find out all the information and be accurate on everything. So when he started wanting to know about bison, he went straight to the source.
Absolutely. You know, one bit of background, when Ted came to Montana, he landed in Montana, and he did it because he needed to relax and wanted to come to the West and kind of reinvent himself. He insulted many of the cattlemen in the region by saying bison were more hygienic and they weren't wimpy like cattle. And the cattlemen considered this a declaration of war. And a couple of things. Bison have proved their resilience. They're better able to withstand changes in climate and weather, and they're predator resistant. And so Ted recognized that, but equally as important, here's a question. How often does one hear about incidents of diabetes in Native Americans historically? You don't. And bison are very healthy animals. They're high in omega-3 and omega-6 vitamins. They're lean. And Ted realized that as he started to raise bison, that they could also be a healthful form of sustenance for people. And so two of Ted's motivations for bison, one is to help restore the landscape using these native animals. And the second thing is to promote good health in America with this source of lean red meat.
And one of the things that a lot of people are aware of now is that the Native American, when they killed the bison, they killed it for a reason and used every single piece that was available for them to use. They didn't just kill it to take the hide or to take a little bit of meat and leave it there for the vultures to devour.
Absolutely. You know, it had a completeness to it. From meat to bones, bones were used as tools. And, you know, bison were the perfect package in terms of feeding, clothing, and providing tools for Native people and culture. And, you know, when 35 million bison went away, it was the U.S. military that knew that in order to defeat Native Americans, you needed to remove the animal that existed in their commissary. At least that's what some generals said. And so they went out to deliberately annihilate bison.
You mentioned earlier, Todd, about Ted's initiative and giving money to the United Nations. And one of the things that we talk about constantly is that our culture, our generation, these people need to learn more about history and they don't remember their history. And you mentioned in your book that Ted Turner could probably teach a lot of political officials, a lot of history teachers, a lesson or two in history when he addresses what happened with the United Nations.
Ted is a student of history, and as he likes to point out, look at what happened to the world when the League of Nations fell apart after World War I. What happened was there was no unified front to confront Adolf Hitler and the other rise of the other dictators, and as a result, we went into World War II. 70 million people died, 70% of them innocent civilians. And as Ted likes to point out for those people who say that the United Nations doesn't have relevance, he says, everything that we value in our global society, safe air travel, great medicine, food safety. You know, in fact, we look at this recent Ebola crisis, and it's because of the World Health Organization that grew out of the UN, the reason why we have this global quarantine procedure and we can safeguard ourselves. One other thing that Ted Turner says is look at global UN peacekeepers. A RAND Corporation study found that 80% of the time UN peacekeeping missions are successful. And as Ted says, the UN isn't perfect, but it's the best thing we have for having a cohesive world. And so, you know, in the late 1990s, when the United States was $1 billion behind in paying its membership dues to the UN, Ted Turner, even though he knew it was unpopular, stepped forward and said, I'm going to give $1 billion to the United Nations because they're essential in our world, and more importantly, they have a key role in addressing this widening gap between the so-called haves and the have-nots in our society. And he is probably one of the UN's greatest champions today.
When we're talking about foreign affairs and diplomats, one of the persons that Ted Turner was friends with and had a good acquaintance with is former leader of the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev.
Indeed. One of the great adventures for me in this book was setting out and interviewing a number of folks. I interviewed Mikhail Gorbachev and Kofi Annan and President Carter and Jane Fonda and Tom Brokaw and a whole suite of characters. But Ted Turner and Mikhail Gorbachev to this day are great friends. And their friendship started when Ted Turner, against the protests of conservatives in the United States, established a CNN bureau in Moscow. And in fact, Gorbachev knew that Ted Turner was no pretender when he sent his eldest son, Teddy, to work in that CNN bureau in Moscow. And Gorbachev told Ted, I knew that you were sincere in seeking friendship when you would send your son to work in a city that was considered the center of what Ronald Reagan had called the evil empire. And interestingly enough, someone who lives in your backyard near El Paso, T. Boone Pickens,
yes,
is a good friend of Ted Turner's and credits Ted with helping to bring down the Soviet Union, because CNN served as this great window for peering in to the Soviet Union. And as Gorbachev says, he and members of the Politburo would watch CNN at the Kremlin.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Todd, but did not CNN headline news take off during Desert Storm because people wanted constant coverage of that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a decision that Ted made. You know, the great late Walter Cronkite of CBS said that one of his regrets in life is that he was never able to work for Ted Turner. And, you know, Ted Turner brought us the first Gulf War live. And many of his innovations with media, it's what caused Time magazine to name him a person of the year, ranking right up there with a bunch of historic figures. And one thing I should note is that there's a growing movement among folks to have Ted Turner, based upon his resume, nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
We're speaking with Todd Wilkinson. Todd is the author of the book Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. Shifting gears a little bit here, Todd, you mentioned at the beginning that when he lost his sister, it caused him to question his faith, and perhaps even more when his father committed suicide. And later on, as he became known in the media, he made a statement once that Christians use Christianity as a crutch, and so he came under fire for that. And then things changed again when allegedly his wife, Jane Fonda, became a Christian or born-again Christian. What does he say, or did he say anything else about his faith issues?
Well, Ted Turner, when he was young, he was raised a Christian, and his youngest sister suffered from terminal lupus, a very painful disease, and Ted watched her suffer, and he prayed to God, and he said, you know, no God would allow my loved one to suffer. And this went on for several years, and it caused Turner to question his own faith. And then when his father took his own life, it really sent him into a period of deep questioning. You know, there's been a lot written in the press suggested that Ted was put off when Jane Fonda became a born-again Christian. It wasn't so much that, it's that they didn't have a great discussion about that. And as Jane will say today, you know, Ted Turner, he may not be religious in an organized religious sense, but he's a deeply spiritual person who believes in the concept of a higher power. But most importantly, he believes that we shouldn't be deferring important decisions in our lives, waiting for the Creator to tell us what to do, but the Creator gave us a brain and demands that we be informed about decisions that we make. And one of the things that Ted believes is we shouldn't be deferring decisions and not treating our environment with respect, thinking that everything will be fine in heaven. We need to treat the earth as heaven on earth, and we need to try and make sure that it is heaven on earth for every species that lives on earth.
In the introduction, which the foreword actually that Ted Turner writes in this book, there's a mention of one of his favorite poems, and that's Horatius at the Bridge. Do you want to tell us about that?
Absolutely. One of the great English poets, Thomas Babington Macaulay, wrote this great verse poem. And early on in Ted Turner's life, he was a national speech and debate champion, something that's little known to people. In fact, many people laugh at the notion because Ted often will stand up and make off-the-cuff remarks that sometimes get him in trouble. But early in his life, he would memorize these great epic poems. And Horatius at the Bridge is about this ancient hero who stood up, and even when his colleagues wouldn't join him, stood to hold a bridge in Rome against invaders who wanted to cross it. And because of Horatius, the empire was saved. And it's really a parable that speaks to Ted Turner. It's about we in our time all need to step up and be counted. We'll be far more successful if we do it by coming together, rather than standing apart and rather than looking out for our own rational self-interest. And so Horatius at the Bridge, it's something I would encourage everyone to look up and read. It's an inspiring poem, and it's one that Ted Turner read when he was captaining Courageous to victory in the America's Cup. He's read it to his former employees at CNN, and he's read it to anyone. I've heard him recite that several times, and it's one of those things that leaves a very positive impression on others.
We're visiting with Todd Wilkinson. Todd is the author of the book Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. You mentioned, and we discussed earlier, about him being a history buff and the fact that the Civil War documentary Ken Burns did for PBS, one of the persons interviewed there is Ted Turner, and also in the American Finest Films. And he talks about how Gone with the Wind inspired him to become a Civil War buff and to collect some of the memorabilia from the Civil War.
Yes, and as everyone who's seen Gone with the Wind knows, you know, there's the famous line that at the end that will always have terror, which is something that speaks to Ted's dream, and Ted believes it speaks to everyone else's dream, which is we all aspire to own property. It's one of these permanent things we can do. It's something that we can pass on to our children as an asset, and it's certainly something Ted Turner is doing. With regard to Ted as a Civil War buff, he is this incredible collector of trinkets. He loves looking for Native American artifacts and examples of paleontology. He champions the collection of that and the shared knowledge. One thing that I found really intriguing is we were walking around Atlanta, around Centennial Park, not far from his home, and he reached down and he picked up trash off the ground and stuffed it in his pocket until he reached a garbage can. And he told me, Mikhail Gorbachev told me the story of how he was once walking with Ted in that same route, and Ted did it, and Gorbachev said, "Ted, what are you doing?" And Ted said, "You know, none of us are too high and mighty that we can't try and leave the earth a little better." And Gorbachev went back to Moscow and did that, and his daughter asked the same question. And Gorbachev recited that, the same thing that Ted had told him. And so the Gorbachev clan began picking up trash in Moscow out on their daily walk, and it left a little ripple effect. And so it's little things like this that Ted Turner does that influences in some ways profoundly other people.
The name of the book is Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet. And with that last line that I just read, to save a troubled planet, his quest, what do you see now that the book has been written and you see Ted Turner? What is going to happen? What is the future for like lands in New Mexico, Montana, or some of the other areas?
You know, that was always the big question that was looming over me as I was writing this book. What if Ted Turner had 2 million acres and then all of it was broken up when he died? He's taken measures in his will that upon his death, all of his land will go under the auspices of the Turner Family Foundation, and they'll be managed sustainably in perpetuity, likely with a partner like the Nature Conservancy. They'll never be developed and subdivided. They'll always be managed for their natural assets, and so his bison herds will persevere, as will his habitat management, which benefits, you know, scores of public wildlife that belong to all of us and that use Ted's lands as a refuge. So Ted is all in. All of his money and all of his land assets will be managed in perpetuity for the public good.
Now, is there a website, Todd, that people can go to find out more about the book or about Ted Turner's quests?
ToddWilkinsonWriter.com. One can also go to TedTurner.com to learn more about Ted Turner. That's something that site's operated by Ted, not by me. And, you know, if I may say so, I would encourage folks, if they're interested, please support their local mom-and-pop booksellers. And if they like, they can always order the book off of Amazon.com. And there's a long list of the reviews that have been published relating to Last Stand.
A lot of them. Well, Todd, thank you very much. And hopefully you can come to El Paso sometime and visit. And maybe you, me, Ted, and Norma can meet up in Raton, New Mexico.
You know what? There's a bison burger with your name on it, and I will treat. So it's been a great pleasure.
Todd, we'd like to thank you very much for joining us here today. We've been visiting with Todd Wilkinson. He is the author of the book, Last Stand, Ted Turner's Quest to Save a Troubled Planet.
The Colt Six Shooter never would have been made had it not been for the Texas Rangers. Before there was a Colt Six Shooter, there was a Colt Five Shooter back in 1835. Samuel Colt couldn't sell it to much of anyone except for Captain John Coffee Hayes and his Texas Rangers. They loved it. The Colt proved itself invaluable in fighting the Comanches, who were the most feared warriors on the Texas plains. Colt's weapon evened the playing field because the Comanches already had a rapid-fire weapon of their own. It was called a bow and arrow. A skilled warrior could pump four arrows into a ranger before he could reload his old single-shot rifle, and the Comanches could do it from horseback, at a gallop. If there had been a MasterCard ad at that time, it would have gone like this. Fastest quarter horse around, $10. Top of the line saddle, $40. Two Colt revolvers, $60. Going up against 40 Comanches with seven fellow Texas Rangers, equally equipped, priceless. When Zachary Taylor was set to invade Mexico, he asked the Rangers to come along. The Rangers said that they would, but they would need Colt revolvers. Taylor said okay, and he ordered 1,000 of them. But Samuel Colt was bankrupt. He didn't even have one Colt revolver left in his possession. He had to put an ad in the paper to get one back so he could copy it. And then he got Eli Whitney of cotton gin fame to help him produce them. The Texas Rangers saved the Colt pistol from extinction. But once Monterrey, Mexico was pacified, General Winfield Scott was ready to move against Santa Anna in Mexico City. General Scott, like Taylor, wanted the Rangers to scout for him. And since there was a little downtime before the invasion, Texas Ranger Samuel Walker, who was no relation to Walker, Texas Ranger, played by Chuck Norris, he had a quick visit with Samuel Colt, and he told him that the five-shooter should be made a six-shooter for better balance. Thus, the six-shooter was born, and it was so heavy that Colt said it would indeed take a Texan to shoot it. This new pistol was called the Walker Colt, and Colt got the finest product placement celebrity endorsement in marketing history. His guns, the official guns of the Texas Rangers. Every soldier wanted one. Every man in the West wanted one. A later version was called the Peacemaker, the gun that tamed the West. As the saying went, God made some men big and some men small. Samuel Colt made equals of them all. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are true.
Stories from Texas are produced by Rio Grande Valley Public Radio in Harlingen.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our engineer has been Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.